Aloha, everyone. Jeremy Vaney here. Welcome to the new year. Although, technically, according to the Chinese calendar, it's still 2020. So Chinese New Year hasn't kicked in yet. I guess we can all just chalk up all this craziness to 2020 still, if we like. Tempted to not do a show. There's a lot of stuff going on that just sort of makes all this feel irrelevant, right? The insurrection, of course. And I don't know how many of you heard about Angela Joyner and her husband passing away due to COVID within about, I think, a day of each other, which played out on her Facebook page like a Shakespearean tragedy. I'm got to be honest with you, fairly fed up with the UFO scene. I think there's a lot of crazy people doing crazy things, saying crazy things, and they have real world, as we see now, crazy ramifications, violent ramifications. And I don't know if I want to be a part of this anymore, to tell you the truth. It was good when it was crazy and innocuous. Now that it's crazy and has real-world consequences, not so much. But I'll probably go more into that on next week's episode, which will be a solo show yet again, where I continue to answer your questions and go deeper and deeper into the self and the enigmatic other. Who said that first? Was that Terrence McKenna? I think so. I could be wrong. A good announcement. We're doing a we being Carol, my wife and I, are putting on another living mystery symposium. We did it a few years ago here in Hawaii. We're doing it again. So far, we have committed Teokas and Ghost Horse, Lahua Lopez, Whitley Strieber, Jeff Kripal, and there's one or two more people I'm trying to lock in, so I won't say their names until they are or are not. And that will likely be in May, if not September, but we're pushing for May. And that will be online. And it will either be completely free or it will be a nominal fee. So I'll fill you in more on that later. But just keep that in the back of your mind. Probably in May, clear up some time to see us all hashing out consciousness. Essentially, it's the theme is reconsidering consciousness. And again, I'll flesh that out on a future episode. And this week's episode is brought to us by Nick Redfern. And I got to say, I was afraid to even edit this thing because I felt like there were a ton of technical difficulties and glitches and stuff as it was recording. But it turns out that most of them are just fine. In fact, technically, this is better than some other episodes I've done. So, but with that said, there are a couple of spots toward the end where things get muddled. But my ear and brain could sort of put together what he was saying, so I'm hoping yours will too. And one of them is just so completely missing that I interrupt to make a joke about it. So my apologies to Nick Redfern about that. But what the parts that you can understand in here, what we'll be talking about, is primarily his book, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Conspiracy, A Close Encounter Exposed as a Top Secret Government Experiment. And then what we'll go into a little bit later is his really new book, because he releases like five at a time now or something. He's incredible. The Martians, Evidence of Life on the Red Planet. So get ready for all of that. Get set for all of that. Non-subscribers, you'll be hearing all of that right after these messages. Subscribers, let's talk to Nick Redfern, arguably the most prolific writer in modern paranormal lit, right now.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
Aloha, Jeremy Vaney here, and I want to tell you about my latest undertaking, OurUndoing.com. OurUndoing.com is a multimedia website where if you watch, if you read, if you listen, without trying to absorb knowledge like we do with normal learning, and without the normal judgmental filters that we use to compare and contrast so-called spiritual knowledge, if we watch, if we read, if we listen, without all of that, we may just wake up to our full human nature. That is what this website is for. It's not about what we're doing, it's about who we are, truly are, when we're off the pendulum of duality. If your life is about seeking truth above all else, look no further. Join me at OurUndoing.com. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please welcome to the experience a man who I think is probably in direct competition with Stephen King to write the most books in his lifetime, Nick Redfern. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going?
Good. Is that accurate? Are you in a contest with Stephen King to write the most books?
Well, I've done round about 60 books altogether. So I guess my answer is I'm not sure.
Fair enough. Well, I want to get into at least one of your books, the Rendlesham book, but I want to ask you some questions about you first, because I don't think people really know. It's funny, because for a guy who's written 60 books in the paranormal / ufological fields, usually that kind of person loves to talk about themselves quite a bit, but I get the feeling that's not a subject as near and dear to your heart as some of the others that you write about. So,
I wouldn't say I sort of go, you know, running around bragging that I've done 60 books or anything like that. But I mean, you know, I'm not someone who feels that I need to post a picture of the last night's pizza I ate or whatever, you know,
right.
or what I did this or I did that. I mean, if it's something like a soccer game or go and see a band, you know, I'll post pictures onto Facebook and things like that. But I don't feel the need to, you know, I saw a rabbit run across the road, you know, and got to run to get a picture on Facebook. I don't need to do that and mess around with all that kind of stuff. So.
Well, we thank you for that. leave that to the professionals, Nick. We're very lonely out here. I guess let me just ask you just first, I mean, having written 60 books and having been at this as long as you have, is there anything that you're looking to prove out with your work, or are you sort of just dabbling around in different subjects and looking, period?
Dabbling. what I try and do is to, you know, take like an investigative approach to what I do. In other words, you know, I don't feel any sort of pressing need to, you know, I don't have like a yearning to hope that Roswell was extraterrestrial or that Rendlesham was extraterrestrial. I go where the evidence and the data takes me. And if the material that I find takes me in this direction or that direction, and it looks like it's the answer, that's where I'll go. Now, in doing that, it may well be the case that some people will say, you know, you're essentially spoiling our fun. You know, I get that quite a bit. But the fact is, I mean, I'm not in the business of putting cool stories together because I think it's going to sort of reap in more and more sales. What I do is go exactly where I think I should be going. And, you know, if I wanted to, you know, make a bestseller of 500,000 copies, I wouldn't be writing books saying aliens didn't come down at Rendlesham or at Roswell. I'd be saying they did, you know. But that's, you know, with my, you know, from looking at it from the perspective of having you know, a conscience, you know, I just go where the data takes me, and if people don't like it, you know, the conclusions I've come up with, well, that's just too bad. I just don't care. You know, people can like what I do or not like it, but they're going to get what I find.
Well, this is interesting because this gets me to, I was just looking at your Amazon page. So the book we're talking about is The Rendlesham Forest UFO Conspiracy, A Close Encounter Exposed as a Top Secret Government Experiment. And one of the reviews I read in there, which was actually, as far as stars go, they give you a high star rating. But the review was like, oh man, Nick, have you sold out or what? Now you're telling me that Betty and Barney Hill is a psyop, everything is a hallucination, you know, all of this. And it got me to thinking, there's often a difference between, like, when you're writing a book or you're doing a podcast and, you know, talking to guests, there's a difference between getting through the story of what the book needs to be and getting to the conclusion of that, of what you're doing, and actually what you think personally, you know, the sort of broader pulled back perspective that may include that piece of it, but you know that that's just a piece of it. But to the audience, they may think, like, every little thing you do means that, for instance, if you're negating aliens in this, that you don't believe in aliens at all, or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, they think you've completely changed, and they don't get that, no, this is just for this book. This is for this work. So I guess I'll just put a question. Do you – okay, well, then there's the answer. I was just going to say, I mean, yeah, do you differentiate between drawing conclusions in your work versus saying this is my final answer on everything?
Well, actually, that's a good point because – I very often get a response where if, like, for example, you know, with the Rendlesham book and me concluding that this was sort of a series of experiments involving hallucinogens and holograms rather than it being extraterrestrial, a lot of people assume, well, you know, you've gone totally away and don't believe in anything other than, you know, down-to-earth experiments or that kind of thing, which isn't true. I mean, I do believe in the existence of a genuine UFO phenomenon. Now, whether it's extraterrestrial or, you know, in theoretical situations like multidimensional, interdimensional, time travelers, demons, you know, I don't know what the phenomenon is, but I do fully believe in a real UFO phenomenon. But that doesn't mean, you know, I sort of go into every case wide-eyed, you know, mouth wide open, because a story sounds exciting and cool. And there's nothing wrong coming across a story that is exciting and cool. But if down the line, the more you get into the story, you see things starting to change, well, you have to do that. But I do get that sort of black and white angle, you know, that Nick doesn't believe aliens came here or there, so that means he's totally left the UFO side, which is not true. You know, I just look at each case or incident that I write about. I just go where I think it's going, if I do think it's the right direction. And if it causes a blowback, well, you know, it's not the kind of thing that I lose sleep over. That's ufology, you know.
Yeah. Well, and so how did this this angle of the Rendlesham incident come across, you know, how did it come across your radar, and then how did it become interesting enough, big enough to you that you decided I need to really investigate this and write a book?
Well, Well, I mean, one of the important things to note first is, you know, the date, the time frame, 1980, and you know, nobody at that time knew about it. And the first book on Rendlesham called Sky Crash came out in 1984, written by Jenny Randalls, Brenda Butler, and Dot Street. And that was the first book. And since then, there have been about six or seven books on Rendlesham. And all of them, to a small degree, have touched on the idea that could Rendlesham have been a secret experiment. And the reason why is probably because if you know your Rendlesham history, more importantly, or equally important, is the, if you know your history of the area. And the reason why I mention that is because going back to the 1930s, in and around the area of Rendlesham Forest, for decades, there have been highly classified military experiments in that area. One of them was a top secret radar operation called Cobra Mist. And if you Google Shingle Street, Second World War, Shingle Street is a little village just down the road from Rendlesham Forest, where a weird experiment was used to try and set fire on an entire sort of contingent of German soldiers that tried to invade the east coast of England. And it involved some sort of bizarre technology. And the more I dug into it, the more I found that there were literally sort of seven or eight highly classified UK military experiments that had all gone on in less than 10 miles from the forest. So that was one of the red flags, you know, the idea that, well, if the seven or eight experiments having gone on in the area since the 1930s, then sort of logic would dictate that this was probably some sort of experiment. But the more I dug into it, the more I found parallels between experimental programs in the 1960s, one called Kugelblitz, which was a US program to try and control ball lightning as a weapon. And these documents have now been declassified by the Freedom of Information Act in the US. But when I started to read them, the way that the description of the experiments sounded just like what is written in the Holt memo that Charles Holt, Colonel Charles Holt, wrote in his memo about what happened on those nights. And so the more I looked into it, and then I found that some of the guys involved talked about how they'd been subjected to hallucinogens. So you put all this together, you know, the hallucinogens, the ball lightning experiments, the fact that there were so many highly classified programs going on there already, you put all that together and you start to put a bigger picture together, and that's what you get. You're either, you know, someone who one person says, you know, Nick's got the answer, and somebody else says, what the fuck is he on about, you know?
Well, let me ask you, I don't even know that you would know the answer to this. I don't know if anyone's even thought to look at it this way, but have you, I'm assuming you've looked at documents from various countries, yeah? As far as all these phenomena go. Can you gather from what you're reading that their interpretations of these phenomena are the same, or their goals in trying to, for instance, control ball lightning? Like, would that be the same in France as the UK, as the US? Are they all on the same page with this stuff, or is everyone just sort of doing their own thing?
Well, I think to a significant degree, it's done on its own. But you have to remember, with Rendlesham, this was kind of a unique situation. The primary reason being because the guys themselves, who were all the guys who were exposed to whatever this phenomenon was, they were all US military, US Air Force, but they were stationed to a pair of UK bases, but they were leased out to the Americans. And so you had Royal Air Force Bentwaters, Royal Air Force Woodbridge, two UK bases loaned out to contingents of US personnel. So in this case, there's no doubt at all that this was some sort of, you know, a I wouldn't say collusion, but a combination of both nations and both intelligence communities getting together and essentially running this experiment in an area that was a perfect place. I mean, you know, it was the heart of a forest, and late at night and in the early hours of the morning. The timing was just 2 days after, 1 day after Christmas Eve. And you probably won't know this, but in the UK, we still have very lengthy holidays at Christmas, like 10 days. You know, everybody takes off that literally like that amount of time from work. So in other words, you had a lot of people all at home over that period of that 3 days, you know, stuff in the stomach with turkey or whatever, got the experiments going late at night and under the cover of a UFO phenomenon. And, you know, and the fact that a lot of the military people, because it was Christmas, they'd actually taken time off for work as well. So a significant number of the people at both bases were gone. So, you know, you put all that together, you've got a perfect timing to ensure that an experiment like this would not be sort of become open to too many people. And it didn't. There were just rumors locally, you know, the locals were like, did you see those strange lights last night? That kind of thing. But nobody had sort of a, you know, a complete tie on it. So, you know, if you look at it from the perspective of the British side and the American side together, clearly, you know, there was a collaboration to figure how the human mind could be played with and messed with to the point, you know, with this combination of hallucinogens, the ball lightning, and holograms, which in the book I point out how that would not actually be too difficult to achieve, but the final goal was essentially to see how the enemy, the mind of the enemy, could be screwed with on the battlefield and create a situation where the enemy really doesn't know what is going on. And when you get the enemy in that position, then you are in charge of the situation.
But the thing of holograms and all that, and even of, I remember, you know, the stories in Vietnam, I think it is, of coming up with vampire stories to scare people, coming up with lore to explain atrocities. You know, so that dates back pretty far. How many decades do they have to do this stuff before they stop experimenting? Like, at what point are they just doing it? You know what I mean?
Well, when it comes to this issue of, you know, how many of these experiments went on and, you know, were they satisfied? The interesting thing is that in the UK, there really have not been any similar situations in the UK similar to Rendlesham. Now, this was December 1980. Now, one of the things I did find, which I mentioned in the book, is that in the sort of months and early years after the event, there were some experiments or incidents, however you want to term it, eerily similar to Rendlesham, but we really don't know much about those. You know, it may have been just testimony from a couple of people who'd retired and wanted to, you know, to share their stories. But beyond those, which made me think that there were a couple more experiments, there really hasn't been anything like Rendlesham in the UK since the early 80s. Now we're almost, you know, into 2021, so we're talking about 40 years ago. So my conclusion is that when they realized that the combination of these different aspects to, you know, to mess with the guys' minds, that they were happy that they'd gone at least as far as they could, and they recognized that, well, if we can mess with the minds of our guys in the woods, then we can sure do the same against the Chinese or the Russians in a theoretical situation if, you know, in a worse scenario, we went to war with them. And, of course, if it causes chaos and confusion, well, that's the last thing you want on the battlefield is chaos and confusion. But if you can show just by doing that one experiment that you really can do that, I think that would, you know, would satisfy them. Now, I'm sure the technology since then has developed, but the basic scenario of messing with minds to make them think seeing something they're actually not, that actual angle, I think, that they were happy at the time and probably still are even now, even though obviously, you know, the technology is going to be more advanced.
Is there any evidence that they were happy that this became public, that was part of the plan all along, or no?
No, but I think to a degree, I'm sure they probably thought at least part of the story would get out, because although you've got Rendlesham Forest and right next to it, well, not now, but you had the old bases, which are now closed down. So, you know, you've got two bases, you've got the forest. Now, surrounding the forest are a lot of sort of typical little English villages, you know, that you might see some old, you know, UK old detective story, you know, in a little village, like a whodunit type thing, you know. And that's how the area is, sort of, I won't say isolated, but it is forest, woods, little villages, that kind of thing. And Sky Crash was the title of the first book written on Rendlesham. And the authors pointed out in that book that some people, some locals, came forward and actually talked about what they'd seen that night, strange lights and like beams of light into the sky and these balls of light, kind of like the ball lightning angle. And people did talk about it, but it was very much a case that nobody really kind of went out of their area, so to speak. And so it was a case of sort of what happens here stays here, that sort of thing. Not kind of literally, but it was like that. So it actually wasn't until 1983 when a tabloid newspaper in the UK called the News of the World managed to get hold of Colonel Holt's memo through the Freedom of Information Act. And that was when, in 1983, when it broke. And bit bars came out and something else came out, drip by drip, bit by bit. And as I said, about 8 or 9, something like that, are the numbers of books that have been written on Rendlesham now. And steadily, you know, there's been new revelations each time. Kind of like with Roswell, you know, every time a new book comes out, it's the basic scenario. But, you know, there are a lot of significant new materials. So,
well, but, you know, the difference is that Roswell,
that's kind of how it began.
Roswell roughly stays the same, right? Like, the new material comes out, and if you believe it, then you're still going to believe aliens crashed and here's what we did. With the exception of, you know, maybe your body snatchers in the desert. But with this, it seems like the over the years, new things, like, we couldn't really decide what it was from the very beginning, right? There was no sense of, like, okay, here's the starting point. This is definitely aliens landed, and here's what happened, and now the story is going to evolve from there. It seems like the story kind of is amorphous. You've got Jim Peniston with his ones and zeros, and, you know, you've got the PSYOP thing, you've got the UFO thing. Is there anything... Well, I'll just ask you, I mean, is there anything that you've seen that would lead credence to this having been a high strangeness phenomenon? And if not, was this material that you have access to, was it not available through the 80s and 90s and early aughts?
Well, that's actually one of the really interesting parts of the story. A lot of people just had overlooked it. Like, for example, this Project Kugel Blitz that I talked about. And when you read it and then you compare it with what Holt said and how the phenomenal situations were pretty much identical. One of the issues was that most people hadn't even bothered looking into this kind of thing. And I would not be surprised You know, if somebody went to the National Archives in Maryland and spent a year there, you know, looking on some legendary UFO case or something else, you would find probably a lot of material. Not because, and it hasn't been hidden. It's just so, you know, that there's so much there. You don't have the file numbers, et cetera, et cetera. It eventually just becomes sort of dusty files, you know, on the fourth floor, that kind of thing. So I think there's that aspect to it. But the other angle that you mentioned, the situation of, well, we didn't really know what it was from the beginning, I actually think that sort of gives weight to the experiment angle. I'll tell you for why. Because we've got an experiment that is an experiment, but it's also an experiment that is designed to create a UFO phenomenon. So from the first from the very beginning, what you've got is a situation confused. On the one hand, there's the rumors coming out of an experiment, but there's also rumors coming out of aliens. And the only real reason I think that can happen is because there are two aspects to it. You've got the camouflage issue, creating a UFO event, and then an experiment. And one of the things that all of the researchers have suggested as well is that to try and get the full story to stay behind the line, so to speak, that probably both governments spread fake stories that, oh, it's a Russian satellite, or, you know, it's an early stealth fighter, or it's early drone. There's good evidence that some of these stories were deliberately inserted into the UFO community to try and push them away from the real angle, and actually sort of create some of the reason of 5 to 6 different theories. As I said, drones, Russian satellites, early stealth planes going out of control. And, you know, you could imagine the UFO researchers of that time, you know, with their heads spinning. Now, I mean, I should stress, you know, when this happened, you know, I was just a kid, you know, I was barely in my teens when all this happened. So I wasn't doing research then, but, you know, the UK being small, and it doesn't take long for, you know, the story to start coming out. Back then, you know, I was, oh, this is great, you know, aliens have landed in England, and I was a full-on believer. As time went on, I became a full-on disbeliever.
We'll be back after this.
Support UnknownCountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
Aloha, Jeremy Vaney here, and I want to tell you about my latest undertaking, OurUndoing.com. OurUndoing.com is a multimedia website where if you watch, if you read, if you listen, without trying to absorb knowledge like we do with normal learning, and without the normal judgmental filters that we use to compare and contrast so-called spiritual knowledge, if we watch, if we read, if we listen, without all of that, we may just wake up to our full human nature. That is what this website is for. It's not about what we're doing, it's about who we are, truly are, when we're off the pendulum of duality. If your life is about seeking truth above all else, look no further. Join me at OurUndoing.com. Welcome back. I would love to know. I know that on Facebook we had a little exchange that sort of made me want to have you on the show about all of this, about debunkers and professional skeptics. And I'd asked you, do you think that they're in some way in on it? because, you know, they're oftentimes scientists. They often write for like science magazines or Aviation Weekly or something, and or Aviation Monthly, whatever it is. But yet they're the ones who come up with the outlandish stuff. Like they were looking at a lighthouse or crop circles are hedgehogs running in a circle. Like whatever the really dumb thing is usually what they come up with. And I'm wondering how they could not at least have come up with this as an angle in the 80s. They would be the people who are smart enough to do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, when we had that little debate, I was kind of looking at it from the perspective when you said, you know, do I think, you know, that, and I said, no. I thought mainly what we're talking about were people within the UFO field, like a ufologist. Now, if you were to ask me, do I think agencies have done this? I absolutely think they've done that. You know, things like the Robertson panel, you know, and trying to mystify the human mind, that kind of thing, and, you know, create trends and, or, you know, how can we get it into pop culture and all this kind of thing. In that sense, with agencies, yes. But I have to honestly say, although I've heard rumors of people who are just ufologists being hired, you know, to create fabricated stories, I've heard rumors like that, but I've not personally come up with something, you know, where John Smith, ufologist, is on the, you know, the NSA's, you know, funding or whatever to pretend nothing really came down at Roswell. I've heard rumors like that, but I've not, you know, found evidence. But there is evidence, you know, of things like the Robertson panel and similar situations to diffuse the subject. Yeah, I'm absolutely sure that's happened within intelligence agencies and the military.
Yeah, I just think, maybe it would just make an interesting fiction story even to find out that someone like Phil Klass or Michael Shermer, or one of these types, you know, through the ages, have been trying to keep the UFO topic alive by doing a double swerve, by claiming it's not UFOs, it's probably a lighthouse, and they know full well that it's not UFOs or a lighthouse, but UFOs is a great cover for PSYOPs. So they're actually trying to keep it alive. That's kind of what I'm wondering.
Well, I mean, I actually did hear rumors over the years about Klass and, you know, his work with, you know, aviation magazines and things like this. He would have been someone who, you know, had a lot of connections and leads. The FBI did declassify on us, and I was hoping, you know, there might be sort of something amazing, but there actually isn't. It's, you know, it's kind of a bit of a yawn, really. But that doesn't take away the fact that, you know, people could have, you know, been on the inside to infiltrate ufology. I mean, by his own admittance, I mean, Bill Moore, you know, was... put in a situation, you know, you help us, we'll help you kind of situation.
Right. Well, let me ask you, within ufology, when you write a book like this, is the feedback you get mostly negative, or is it a lot of kudos? I mean, are people upset that you wrote this, or are they glad to find this stuff out?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say what everybody thinks, but what I will tell you is that most people who respond with reviews on Amazon, which we touched on briefly earlier, most of the reviews I get are positive. I mean, for example, the Rendlesham book and both my two Roswell books, both of which, you know, suggest aliens didn't come down at Roswell, I think the collective reviews are all about 4.5 out of 5, you know.
But what about the researchers? You know, like the people you're friends with in these topics, or your colleagues, if you consider them colleagues, and especially the ones who have written about Rendlesham in the past, are they receptive to this or no?
Well, I mean, most of my friends and, the people who I sort of deal with, work with, and hang out with, you know, they do have sort of the mindset where they're open, you know. Now, obviously, I can't say that for everybody, but for the community that I'm, you know, of ufology that I'm in, you know, most people are rational to, you know, to look at both sides, or if there's a third or a fourth side to it, you know. But, of course, you're always going to get someone who, you know, I mean, I one of the things that I do get now and again, and usually doesn't come directly, it comes via other people, is that, oh, Nick's been hired, you know, by this agency or that agency to write this book and that one. That, I probably get, I would say I get a variation on that at least 2 to 3 times a month.
God.
By someone.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm not kidding that, you know, one, I mean, I made a joke about it at one point, you know, you expect to be, I'm working for the NSA this week and then the CIA next week and then MJ-12 the week after that, you know. And the other angle is that you're doing it because, you know, it's good money. And, well, you know, I mean, if people are interested, you know, I was driving a Ferrari and, you know, living in the, you know, Beverly Hills or something, I guess I could say, well, people might wonder, but, you know, that's not how I live. You know, I enjoyed what I do. I love what I do. You know, I work from home. I don't have a boss. You know, I can sit around wearing T-shirts and jeans all day. But the fact is, you know, unless you're really successful, you know, or lucky, nobody's going to get really rich on writing books about Rendlesham Forest, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, or the Black Eyed Children. You know, it's not going to happen. So in other words, I do what I do because I enjoy it. It's my passion. But the idea, you know, of me sort of having a dual life of, you know, doing this on the one hand as a ufologist or a cryptozoologist, but then the other side, you know, sort of getting a paycheck from this NSA or whatever. I mean, I can understand slightly as to how some people who are the really paranoid type, but I mean, it's so far off reality to be laughable, but unfortunately that demonstrates a significant portion of ufology, and I'm not being critical. What I'm doing is demonstrating what I see, and what I see and hear is that every couple of times a month, somebody or a friend will pop up and say, you know, I spoke to Nick the other day, and I don't know what to think about him. You know, he could be with them. You know. You know.
Oh boy. Well, and on that note, I suppose maybe this question, it's sort of the same question, but in terms of the men who were directly involved in Rendlesham, have you heard anything, any feedback from them? How solid is a Jim Peniston or any of them in what they believe happened to them? Would they be open to this or not?
Well, Jim Peniston stands by his, you know, scenario of what may have been from the future, coming back to try and, you know, fix the future. And Jim, you know, has written his own book. He was one of the first people out there. You know, he's one of him, Holt, and John Burroughs were, you know, the three primary figures. And John was there in the woods, in the military. At the same time, I was like, you know, 13-year-old kid at school. So, you know, you have to give the guys, you know, what they said. What I will say, right now, John Burroughs, who is one of the trio, the three primary guys in the woods, John has got his new book out now. And if you can actually see it on my Facebook page where I did a review on it. And if you read that, the review, you'll see that John's book is in massively similar to my book. he's gone right over to the experiment angle.
Wow. Okay.
So in other words, even now, between the guys, there's now this sort of situation of, Jim thinks, the time travel potential angle. You've got Holt, who goes with the extraterrestrial angle. John Burroughs, a significant portion of his book about the secret experiments, even with the ball lightning and things like that I talk about, that's all in his book as well. So that's just come out. So John's gone right round. So even within the guys, there's this division in the same way that there is in ufology, which is kind of interesting, that both sides, the guys involved and the researchers, even them are sort of having this parallel kind of argument.
Well, I want to step back and ask you sort of a broader question about, witnesses and people who have high strangeness experiences who you've talked to, because I'm certain you've talked to a cross-section of occupations. And I'm wondering if you've noticed a difference, and even if you haven't talked to them firsthand, just in the videos that you've seen or the testimonials you've read, is there a huge difference between what a physicist would say in public, what a garbage person would say in public, a McDonald's worker, a military person, a politician, a psychologist? Like, does one's occupation play into how and what they say publicly? And also, do you think it informs what they think personally?
I think most people I know, regardless of which side of the coin they're on, most of them do, that I know at least, do stand by what they have concluded. Now, I have seen some situations at conferences where, unfortunately, I've seen certain people well-known in ufology, who I won't name, but everybody knows them, went into conferences where I've been to a conference and maybe there's 7 or 8, 9 investigators and lecturers all over the course of a weekend. And I've seen some of those people who I know do not believe this or that, but they won't rock the boat with some of the other people because they don't want to rock the boat. They want to make sure they get and booked for the next conference, the next one, and they hope that someone's going to refer them to, the latest TV show on this channel or that channel. So I've seen that happen, to sort of a ridiculous, fawning, almost down on knees kind of angle, saying the right things to the right person because they think it's going to be good for their career. I've seen that kind of thing, where saying one thing at one point to one person and saying something to somebody else purely because it's going to look good. I've been in situations where people have felt awkward around me, and they said, well, we didn't really want to say anything in case you blew up at me. I'd be like, well, I've got better things to blow up at than just somebody who thinks that, should they say this to me? So I'm like, well, now tell me what you think, so that does happen. All this sort of fawning behind the scenes stuff, kind of get in with the right people. It's pretty pathetic, really. And if you've got a theory, you should go for it. And if you've made a good case, people should recognize it. And if they don't like it and it sort of upsets their mindset or their belief system, well, it's just tough. That's how it goes. And if your mind as a mindset cannot stand it, well, there's something wrong with you,
Yeah. Well, that's all certainly a problem. I guess I'm also wondering if, we talk about filters and how we view these events that happen. And so when they happen to you, you see a UFO or you have what you think is an alien encounter, It's like you've got your cultural filter, you've got all these filters, but the one that doesn't get any play really is your occupational filter and how you see yourself in society and how embarrassed you might be to say something out loud a certain way. And then add on top of that sort of the O.J. Simpson factor of like you could probably convince yourself that it happened the way you said it out loud, even though the way you said it out loud was to please all of these people and because of this sense of, for instance, embarrassment. But if you repeat it enough, maybe you start to believe it happened that way. And I just wonder, you know, you got all these sort of psychological mechanisms going on in people like that. Can we ever know anything about these phenomena, or is it always going to be just whatever you make of it is what you make of it? Because this isn't like, I don't know, history or physics or archaeology where you make a discovery and suddenly that changes everything we thought we knew about our history or about, you know, modern man or whatever it is. This is like you make a new discovery and it goes on the pile, right? Like, so what do we actually know? Anything?
Well, you mean what do we know in terms of the phenomenon?
Yeah, can we? I guess a fairer question is, do you believe that we can know anything for certain about this?
Well, I mean, in my view, I do believe, like I said earlier, I do believe there's a genuine UFO phenomenon, and it interacts with us to a very significant degree, and sometimes like in an intimate degree. And also, the phenomenon clearly has the ability to radically alter the mindset of people where overnight or in a few days, you know, sometimes people become obsessed with this phenomenon, obsessed in, you know, in a literally obsessive fashion, which is never, you know, healthy for anybody, really. But this phenomenon does seem to have the ability to...
And naturally, this is where the audio cut out for a few seconds. Sorry, Nick. Looks like you were onto something. Somebody doesn't want you to talk.
The sort of mindsets, you know, very, very quickly. And I think, you know, that's part of it. It's sort of, you know, a situation where almost like a learning situation or, you know, for a reason, you know, put people on different pathways. So I do think we can sort of recognize that side of the phenomenon. But if you ask me, you know, can we prove they're aliens or time travelers or they're this or that? No. All what, since 47, are sightings, encounters, contactees, abductees, that kind of thing. And it's clear, you know, that these people, in my mind, a lot of them are having genuine experiences. But to get to the core of the origin, what really is going on, and what they are and where they're from, if we're honest with ourselves, we don't really have an answer to the where they're from, you know, what their gender is. We have no answers. We have theories and concepts, and that's fine, providing you make people realize that they are just theories and scenarios.
Now, I don't want to book hop too much here because... I don't want to lose focus, but as I was looking at your book online, I came across The Martians, Evidence of Life on the Red Planet, which I didn't realize you had written it. Did you just, I mean, really, what are you writing in your sleep? I mean, this book after book after book, it's amazing. But I guess I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, that's only come out, actually.
Okay, good.
Well, that came out about 2 months ago, and I wrote that because actually that is one of the things where, you know, I genuinely do think there are some really weird, you know, things on Mars and photographed. Now, everybody, you know, immediately thinks of the face on Mars and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there's far more to it than that. And I've always been fascinated, you know, with this, a lot of these anomalies. And I thought, now, this was sort of the time to do that, and that's what I've done. And but in that book as well, you know, I've in parts of it, you know, I'm quite scathing about some people, or I've viewed them as you know, too credible, that kind of thing. So again, I think it's important to do that rather than just say this or that because, you know, you're worried about the next event or whatever, that kind of thing. But you have to, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you have to say what you think, you know, the this is or that is. But so many times, I mean, your belief systems are so strong in any scenario, you know, whether it's UFOs or it's politics or what it is. I mean, you only have to look, you know, the elections now, and you've got journalists going around and saying, you know, do you think the election was rigged? And no matter what side they're on, you know, one saying, yeah, it was rigged, and the other one saying, no, it was a legitimate win. I mean, this kind of tells ufology. Everybody's got an opinion. Very often, it's a controversial and an expansive dispute as well. So, but it's more about us as people and our characters more than it does specifically it's UFOs or it's politics or it's what it is, you know. But in saying that, I'm actually now able to take a deep breath now that Biden is actually in.
Yeah, well, there's that. Yeah, for sure.
I don't really talk about politics that much, and I don't, you know, don't bother me what politics yours are. But for me, you know, a few days ago, I actually thought, you know, sort of a degree of, you know, the election. I actually wondered, are we actually really going to get elections again, ever? You know.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, for me, I don't mind saying, you know, for me, it's been Biden all the way. But I have friends who are like, Nick, you know, you've been deceived and all this kind of stuff. So
do the work, man. Don't live in fear.
Yeah.
They say things like that.
I think, again, you can make these parallels, whether it's politics or it's people who go ghost hunting. You know, some people say, you know, it's the souls come back, or somebody says, you know, it's sort of like a tulpa because people yearning for their relatives and a dead relative, that kind of thing. Somebody thinks the Loch Ness Monster is a plesiosaur. Somebody thinks it's a giant eel. You know, this is really across the board, you know, the whole situation of yes and no and theories and concepts and how it's going to dispute situations at conferences and, you know, saying the wrong thing to the wrong person. Well, saying the right... when people talk about saying the wrong thing, what they usually mean is it's the right thing, but they don't want to deal with it.
Right, yeah. Well, what I wanted to ask you about The Martian... or The Martians, I was going to say The Martian book, but it's actually called The Martians, is, I know you deal with documents in that book as well, official documents. Is it easier to get official documents regarding something like life on Mars than it is for the Rendlesham case or vice versa? Like, do you have any problems getting access to documents through FOIA requests for any particular topic over another, or is it all basically the same?
Well, I mean, one of the important things for people who are sort of thinking about perhaps, you know, filing for a Freedom of Information Act request is you have to be very sort of on the ball and explicit about what you're talking about. For example, if you said, let's say hypothetically, you wanted to go looking for files on Rendlesham Forest, well, if, let's say, the Rendlesham Forest event has a specific, highly classified name. In other words, the project has let's say it's called Project XXZZYY, something like that. Well, if you request files on Rendlesham Forest, when actually the program is called XXYYZZ, agencies are not obliged to reveal, you know, anything they found, and they, you know, they're allowed to, you know, we can or cannot confirm ABC, because you are not technically asking for information on Rendlesham, on the experiment. You're asking for information on a generic term. And they are allowed to say in that kind of situation, well, let's say the Roswell incident, whether it was a secret experiment or it was aliens, there surely would be, you know, a highly classified program that's got everything hidden, whether even if it's just documentation. Now, asking the, you know, the military for files on Roswell is not the same as asking for files from this highly classified titled program. You have to be extremely careful and direct, you know, and with the right data and program names and numbers to, you know, to ensure that you actually, I mean, it's not like, you know, sort of looking for the FBI's file on Marilyn Monroe, shall we say, you know, or Frank Sinatra, somebody like that. Everybody knows their names, and so, and if they've got files, they will release them. The FBI is really good at releasing its files. But if you're dealing with a classified title, then you have to, you know, you better have the right project names, that kind of thing, because otherwise you will not get what you're looking for, because you're actually looking with not, everybody knows what you're looking for, but it's the terminology of the request that right. can cause problems.
Well, now that you brought up Roswell, maybe just one question about that, which is, are any of those documents that, you know, we used to see in the 80s and 90s on every TV show with the blacked out, and some had just completely blacked out pages. Do you know, are any of those still classified, and is there a reason to still have classified documents from 1947, especially if this was all about, like, spy balloons and stuff like that? Like, is there a reason you could see? But maybe the question's superfluous because maybe they're not classified anymore. Have those all been declassified to your knowledge?
Well, it's not a case that they're not declassified. Now, I haven't seen files that have, you know, totally 100% withheld, but what I have seen on many occasions is that instead of withholding everything, just the sensitive portions are blacked out, and other things that may not be quite as sensitive, that material may be released because it's not, as I said, not as sensitive as you know, other aspects of the documentation. I'll give you an example. When the space shuttle Challenger exploded in 1986, well, the FBI opened a file on that. That file has been declassified, but portions of the file are still blacked out. So it's not like, you know, the entire file on the shuttle explosion is hidden or withheld. It isn't, but portions of it are. And that's typically how things are now. However, I would say something like Rendlesham, because, you know, just to admit the Rendlesham file would sort of, you know, blow the whole thing wide out anyway. But again, using terminology and not being able to find the genuine program title is enough of a means to prevent you from getting the material.
Well, I guess having read a number of these documents, are you able to ascertain just by looking at where in the document or even in the sentence something's been redacted or blacked out, what it's about? Like, can you sort of formulate in your mind, like, I bet I know what this is and I know why it's blacked out, or is that impossible?
Well, yeah, I mean, if, say, for example, you know, you're looking at a personal file, like something like Frank Sinatra, you know, you could, if you're an expert, let's say, on Frank Sinatra, you know, and you find somebody's name and you know what the connection was between him and the other person, you could probably, in some ways, you know, sort of perhaps make a connection and think, ah, hang on, this kind of similar what I was writing about or researching 2 years ago. But what I would say, those blacked out areas, they don't just black it out. The the US government, in terms of the Freedom of Information Act, they have different levels and different reasons for hiding material. Now, the most prevalent one that you see in the documents is a provision called B1, and B1 covers national security. So if you ever see any declassified files, let's say from the FBI, again, let's just use Frank Sinatra again, and on page 50 of his file, it says Frank on Saturday night, Frank, and then he's blacked out, and then there's a black marker next to it saying B1. That means Sinatra had some issue, which had had some sort of connection to national security. Then you've got B2 and B3, B4, and these, some of them, for example, allow for data to be withheld for medical reasons, or if it might reveal the name of, let's say, an FBI agent wrote a report and it was going to be declassified. The FBI is very careful to black out the names of the agent that wrote that particular report, because, you know, they don't want their agents' names and addresses to be put into the public domain. You know, that makes sense. But the important thing to note is that there are all these different legislations all throughout the Freedom of Information Act that do allow, for multiple reasons, for keeping the material back. And national security, as I said, is the most prevalent, hiding the names of the personnel involved in case they're still alive and they don't want some crazy ufologist, you know, knocking on the front door saying, oh, you know, I found your file, I want to speak to your grandfather, that kind of thing. So there are legitimate reasons why, you know, material should be withheld. But there are also areas where it does sometimes become difficult, you know, when you are dealing with program titles, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, I guess maybe just one more question about the Martians. Were there documents like that that you looked at that were blocked out, that were you weren't able to get to? I mean, anything that sort of says, they might already know all about what I'm looking at here, what I'm trying to figure out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a good classic example, nothing to do with UFOs, but I mentioned earlier about going to the National Archives. I did that several times in the early 2000s. And one of the things I found was it was one of the part of the Department of the Defense. And it was when the U.S. government had deep concerns that foreign nations or terrorists might try to infiltrate the U.S. cattle herd and create viruses and diseases within the U.S. cattle herd and the entire food chain, and sort of bring the U.S. down by releasing viruses, microbes, that kind of thing. And these go back to the 40s, and some of those documents are still blacked out. And again, it's for B1, national security issues. But again, you could imagine they would be classified at B1, because if you're talking about foreign potential, you know, dangerous nations, enemies, potentially, you know, unleashing something that brings our food chain to a grinding halt in weeks, you could see why that would be placed under national security. So, you know, the guys and the women there are evil people, you know, sort of rubbing their hands together. You know, it's not like that at all. Looking to legitimately see what can be released versus what may genuinely impact on national security. And that's not me, just walking away, and, you know, it's me looking at it from both perspectives. You know, there are genuine reasons to keep some things back. Other things, like if a UFO crashes and aliens really do exist, I think we should have the right to know that. But do I think you should be releasing data on the X-scale latest missiles can go high in the sky, you know, is it 50,000 or 60,000 feet? Do I think that should be put in the public domain? No, I don't, because that would be reckless. You know, so that's kind of my approach. I'm not one of these people who thinks everything's got to be released, because everything shouldn't be released.
Right. But so you didn't find anything B1-ish about having to do with Mars, or did you?
No, I didn't. But what I did find was that the CIA, they actually ran a remote viewing program in May 1984, and they remote viewed Mars on a number of occasions throughout May and into June and July. And what's interesting is that so far, although there are references to other remote viewings of Mars in that same era, 1984, so far, we've only got the results from one of these remote viewing programs. And the CIA quietly released that into the public domain in the early 2000s. And it talks about, I mean, bear in mind, you know, everybody's got a view on remote viewing. Some people think it's valid, others don't. Some think it's in somewhere in between. But they had their remote viewers look at Mars in the distant past and came back with images of, like, the atmosphere of Mars on fire and massive earthquakes and these Martians looking eerily like us but much taller and bigger, running for these huge underground bunkers which seemingly had been put into place in the sense that the Martians realized that there was some looming disaster, something like a asteroid strike or something like an equivalent of a nuclear one that we could have here. But what's interesting for me is not just so much as to what the remote viewers found, but why did the CIA feel so, why did they feel so galvanized, if you like, to look into the ancient history of Mars? That's what we don't have the answer to. We know that the remote viewers were looking at Mars from the offices in the CIA. What we don't know is what led them to do it in the first place. That makes me think that somebody within the CIA had a reason to go to work and say, oh, I think I'm going to remote view Mars today. You know, so clearly I think somebody within the CIA knew something or suspected something and wanted somebody to look into it. Now, what that thing might be, that's the bigger question and the bigger answer. And but as I said, there are some files that have not surfaced yet, so that may have, you know, a reasoning to it as well.
Well, that is a good tantalizing question to end it on. So thank you very much for doing this. Nick Redfern, author of The Rendlesham Forest UFO Conspiracy, The Martians, It, and The Shining. Wait, no, not those two. Thank you for thanks for coming on. And yeah, I always find you to be an interesting person to talk to. So I'm glad when you humor me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Jeremy. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, I do what I do, but I mean, I kind of just view me as a regular guy who happens to have a weird interest, you know, or weird interests. And that's how I like to keep it, you know.
Very good. All right. Well, if people want to, I guess I'll have a link, but just tell everybody what your blog is if people want to keep up with you.
Yeah, sure. Well, my blog's called World of Whatever, so just Google Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, and you'll find me there. And you can also reach me at Amazon. I have an Amazon page. And if you go on Facebook, you can actually find, and this even sort of amazed me, there are like about 50 Nick Redferns on Facebook, which I did not think there would be that many. But if you just search me on Facebook, you'll see me almost immediately on my motorbike and my Misfits beanie.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, sir. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
And that's all the time we have for this week's show. My thanks again to Nick Redfern for doing this. Thank you all for listening. Links to his stuffs are along with this episode at unknowncountry.com. Next week, I will be doing another solo show, as promised, and we'll get into some of the deep stuff yet again. All right. Take care, everybody. Stay safe out there? Please do.